idea. What is this committee? It sounds as if they had been making a report. And so we did. You will meet them presently in the cave. But now, excuse my mentioning it, there is a matter to arrange before we go.
Here, Merlin examined his toes with a doubtful eye, hesitating to continue.
Men's brains, he explained in the end, seem to get petrified as they grow older. The surface becomes perished, like worn leather, and will no longer take impressions. You may have noticed it.
I feel a stiffness in my head.
Now, children have resilient plastic brains, continued the magician with relish, as if he were talking about caviar sandwiches. They can take impressions before you could say Jack Robinson. To learn a language when you are young, for instance, might literally be called child's play. But after middle age, one finds it is the devil.
I have heard people say so.
What the committee suggested was that if you are to learn these things we speak of, you ought... you ought to be a boy. They have furnished me with a patent medicine to do it. You understand, you would become the wart once more.
Not if I had to live my life again, replied the old fellow evenly. They faced each other like image and object in a mirror, the outside corners of their eyes drawn down with the hooded lids of age.
It would only be for the evening.
The elixir of life?
Exactly. Think of the people who have tried to find it.
If I were to find such a thing, I would throw it away.
I hope you are not being stupid about children, asked Merlin, looking vaguely about him. We have high authority for being born again, like little ones. Grown-ups have developed an unpleasant habit lately, I notice, of comforting themselves for their degradation by pretending that children are childish. I trust we are free from this.
Everybody knows that children are more intelligent than their parents.
You and I know it, but the people who are going to read this book do not. Our readers of that time, continued the necromancer in a grim voice, have exactly three ideas in their magnificent noddles. The first is that the human species is superior to others. The second, that the 20th century is superior to other centuries. And the third, that human adults of the 20th century are superior to their young. The whole illusion may be labelled progress, and anybody who questions it is called puerile, reactionary, or an escapist. The march of mind, God help them.
He considered these facts for some time, then added,
And a fourth piece of scientific claptrap which they are to have rejoices in the name of anthropomorphism. Even their children are supposed to be so superior to the animals that you must never mention the two creatures in the same breath. If you begin considering men as animals, they put it the other way round and say that you are considering animals as men, a sin which they hold to be worse than bigamy. Imagine a scientist being merely an animal, they say. Tut, tut, and tilly-folderido.
Who are these readers?
The readers of the book.
What book?
The book we are in.
Are we in a book?
We had better attend to the job, said Merlin hastily.
He took hold of his wand, rolled up his sleeves, and fixed a tight eye on the patient.
Do you agree?
He asked. But the old king stopped him. No, he said, with a sort of firm apology. I have earned my body and mind with many years of labour.
It would be undignified to change them. I am not too proud to be a child, Merlin, but too old. If it were my body which were to be made young, it would be unsuitable to keep an old mind in it. While, if you were to change them both, the labour of living all those years would turn to vanity. There is nothing else for it, Master. We must keep the state of life to which it has pleased God to call us.
The magician lowered the wand.
But your brain, he complained, it is like a fossilized sponge. And would you not have liked to be young, to frisk about and feel your knees again? Young people are happy, are they not? We had meant it for a pleasure.
It would indeed have been a pleasure. And thank you for thinking of it. But life is not invented for happiness, I do believe. It is made for something else.
Merlin chewed the end of his stick while he considered.
You are right, he said in the end. I was against the proposal from the start. But something will have to be done to supple your intellects for all that, or you will never catch the new idea. I suppose there would be no objection to a cerebral massage if I could manage it. I should have to get my galvanic batteries, my extra reds and underviolets, my French chalk and my pinches of this and that, a touch of adrenaline and a sniff of garlic, you know the kind of thing.
No, if you think it is right.
He extended his hand into the ether with a well-remembered gesture, and the apparatus began to materialize obediently, muddled up as usual. Chapter 3. The treatment was unpleasant. It was like having one's hair brushed vigorously the wrong way, or like having a sprained ankle flexed by that dreadful kind of masseurs who urges people to relax. The king gripped the arms of his chair, closed his eyes, clenched his teeth, and sweated. When he opened them for the second time that evening, it was on a different world.
"Good heavens!" he exclaimed, jumping to his feet. In leaving the chair, he did not take his weight upon his wrists like an old man, but upon the palms and phalanges. "Look at the dog's hollow eyes. The candles are reflected from the back, not from the front, as if it were from the bottom of a cup. Why have I never noticed this before? And look here, there is a hole in Bathsheba's bath which needs darning. What is this entry in the book? Suspendata? Who has betrayed us into hanging people? Nobody deserves to be hanged. Merlin, why is there no reflection from your eyes when I put the candles between us? Why have I never thought about it? The light comes red from a fox, green from a cat, yellow from a horse, saffron from a dog. And look at that falcon's beak! It has a tooth in it like a saw. Goshawks and sparrowhawks do not have a tooth. It must be a peculiarity of Falco. What an extraordinary thing a tent is! Half of it is trying to push it up, the other half is trying to pull it down. Ex nihilo res fit. And look at those chessmen! Checkmate, indeed! Nay, we will try the ploy again.
Imagine a rusty bolt on the garden door, which has been set wrong, or the door has sagged on its hinges since it was put on, and for years that bolt has never been shot efficiently, except by hammering it or by lifting the door a little and wriggling it home with effort. Imagine, then, that the old bolt is unscrewed, rubbed with emery paper, bathed in paraffin, polished with fine sand, generously oiled, and reset by a skilful workman with such nicety that it bolts and unbolts with the pressure of a finger, with the pressure of a feather, almost so that you could blow it open or shut. Can you imagine the feelings of the bolt? They are the feelings of glory which convalescent people have after a fever. It would look forward to being bolted, yearning for the rapture of its sweet, successful motion. For happiness is only a by-product of function,
as light is a byproduct of the electric current running through the wires. If the current cannot run efficiently, the light does not come. That is why nobody finds happiness who seeks it on its own account. But man must seek to be like the working bolt, like the unimpeded run of electricity, like the convalescent whose eyes long thwarted in their sockets by headache and fever, so that it was a grievous pain to move them, now flash from side to side with the ease of clean fishes in clear water. The eyes are working, the current is working, the bolt is working, so the light shines. That is happiness, working well.
"Hold hard," said Merlin. "After all, we have no train to catch."
"No train?"
"I beg your pardon. It is a quotation which a friend of mine used to apply to human progress. However, as you look as if you were feeling better, shall we start for the cave at once?"
"Immediately." They made no further ado, but lifted the tent flap and were gone, leaving the sleeping greyhound to watch the hooded hawk in solitude. Hearing the tent flap lift, the blinded bird screamed out in raucous accents for attention. It was a bracing walk for both of them. The wild wind and the speed of their passage tugged their beards to left or right over their shoulders, accordingly as they did not face exactly into the eye of it, which gave a tight feeling at the hair roots, as if they were in curl papers. They sped over Salisbury Plain, past the thought-provoking monument of Stonehenge, where Merlin, in passing, cried a salutation to the old gods whom Arthur could not see, to Crom, Bell, and others. They whirled over Wiltshire, strode beyond Dorset, and sped through Devon as fast as a wire cutting cheese. The plains, downs, forests, moors, and hillocks fell behind them. The glinting rivers swung past like the spokes of a turning wheel. In Cornwall they halted, by the side of an ancient tumulus, like an enormous molehill, with a dark opening in its side.
"We go in."
"I have been to this place before," said the king, standing still in a kind of catalepsy.
"Yes."
"When?"
"When yourself."
He groped, searched in his mind, feeling that the revelation was in his heart. "But
no,"
he said, "I cannot remember."
"Come and see."
They went down the labyrinthine passages, past the turnings which led to the bedchambers, to the middens, to the storerooms, and to the place where you went if you wanted to wash your hands. At last the king stopped, with his fingers on the door-latch at the end of a passage, and announced,
"I know where I am."
Merlin watched.
"It is the badger's set, where I went when I was a child."
"Yes."
"Merlin, you villain! I have been mourning you for half a lifetime, because I thought you were shut up like a toad in a hole, and all the time you've been sitting in the combination room arguing with Badger.
Open the door and look."
He opened it. There was the well-remembered room. There were the portraits of long-dead badgers, famous for scholarship or godliness. There were the glow-worms and the mahogany fans and the tilting board for circulating the decanters. There were the moth-eaten gowns and the chairs of stamped leather. But best of all, there were his earliest friends, the preposterous committee. They were rising shyly to their feet to greet him. They were confused in their humble feelings, partly because they had been looking forward to the surprise so much, and partly because they had never met real kings before, so that they were afraid he might be different. Still, they were determined that they ought to do the thing in style. They had arranged that the proper thing would be to stand up, and perhaps to bow or smile a bit. There had been solemn consultations among them about whether he ought to be addressed as Your Majesty or as Sir,
about whether his hand ought to be kissed, about whether he would be much changed, and even, poor souls, about whether he would remember them at all. They were there, in a circle round the fire. Badger hoisting himself bashfully to his feet, while a perfect avalanche of manuscript shot out of his lap into the fender. T. Natrix uncoiling himself and flickering an ebon tongue with which he proposed to kiss the royal hand if necessary. Archimedes bobbing up and down with pleasure and anticipation, half spreading his wings and causing them to flutter like a small bird asking to be fed. Balin looking crushed for the first time in his life because he was afraid he might have been forgotten. Caval, so agonized by the glory of his feelings that he had to go away into a corner and be sick. Goat, who had given the emperor's salute in a flash of foresight long before. Hedgehog, standing loyal and erect at the bottom of the circle, where he had been made to sit apart from the others on account of his fleas, but full of patriotism and anxiety to be noticed if possible. Even the enormous stuffed pike, which was a novelty over the mantelpiece beneath the founder, seemed to regard him with a supplicating eye. "Oh, people!" exclaimed the king. Then they all flushed a great deal and shuffled their feet, and said that he must please to excuse their humble home, or "Welcome to your majesty," or "We did mean to put up a banner, only it had got lost," or "Are your regal feet wet?" or "Here comes the squire," or "Oh, it is so lovely to see you after all these years." Hedgehog saluted stiffly, saying, "Rule Britannia!" The next moment, a rejuvenated Arthur was shaking hands with all, kissing them and thumping them on the back until the tears stood in every eye. "We did not know," sniffed the badger. "We were afraid you might have forgot. Do we say your majesty, or do we say sir?" He sensibly answered the question on its merits. "It is your majesty for an emperor, but for an ordinary king, it is sir." So, from that moment they thought of him as the wart, without considering the matter further. When the excitement had died down, Merlin closed the door and took control of the situation. "Now," he said, "we have a great deal of business to transact, and very little time to do it in. Here you are, King. Here is a chair for you at the head of the circle, because you are our leader, who does the hard work and suffers the pains. And you, Urchin, it is your turn to be Ganymede, so you had better fetch the Madeira wine and be quick about it. Hand round a big cup for everybody, and then we will start the meeting." Hedgehog brought the first cup to Arthur, and served him with importance on a bended knee, keeping one grubby thumb in the glass. Then, while he moved off round the circle, the sometime wart had leisure to look about him. The combination room had changed since his last visit, a change which hinted strongly at his tutor's personality. For there, on all the spare chairs and on the floor and on the tables, lying open to mark significant passages, were thousands of books of all descriptions, each one forgotten since it had been laid down for future reference, and all covered with a fine layer of dust. There was Thierry and Pinot and Gibbon and Sigismondi and Duruy and Prescott and Parkman and Ysserand and Dalton and Tacitus and Smith and Trevelyan and Herodotus and Dean Milman and Macalister and Geoffrey of Monmouth and Wells and Clausewitz and Giraldus Cambrensis, including the lost volumes on England and Scotland, and Tolstoy's War and Peace and the Comic History of England and the Saxon Chronicle and the Four Masters. There were De Beer's Vertebrate Zoology, Elliot Smith's Essays on the Evolution of Man, Eltringham's Senses of Insects, Brown's Vulgar Errors, Aldrovandus, Matthew Paris, a bestiary by Physiologus, Fraser in the complete edition, and even Zeus by A. B. Cook. There were encyclopedias, charts of the human and other bodies, reference books like Witherby about every sort of bird and animal, dictionaries, logarithm tables, and the whole series of the DNB. On one wall, there was a digest made out in Merlin's longhand, which showed, in parallel columns, a concordance of the histories of the human races for the last 10,000 years. The Assyrians, Sumerians, Mongols, Aztecs, etc., each had a separate ink, and the year, AD or BC, was written on a vertical line at the left of the columns, so that it was like a graph. Then, on another wall, which was even more interesting, there was a real graph, which showed the rise and fall of various animal races for the last 1,000,000,000 years. When a race became extinct, its line met the horizontal asymptote and vanished. One of the latest to do this was the Irish elk. A map, done for fun, showed the position of the local birds' nests in the previous spring. In a corner of the room, remote from the fire, there was a work table with a microscope on it, under whose lens there was laid out an exquisite piece of micro-dissection, the nervous system of an ant. On the same table, there were the skulls of men, apes, fish, and wild geese, also dissected, in order to show the relation between neopallium and corpus striatum. Another corner was fitted up with a sort of laboratory, in which, in indescribable confusion, there stood retorts, test tubes, centrifuges, germ cultures, beakers, and bottles labelled pituitary, adrenaline, furniture polish, venticatulum's curry powder, or de Kuyper's gin. The latter had a pencilled inscription on the label which said, "The level on this bottle is marked." Finally, there were meat safes containing live specimens of mantes, locusts, and other insects, while the remainder of the floor carried a debris of the magician's passing crazes. These were croquet mallets, knitting needles, pastel surfin, lino-cutting tools, kites, boomerangs, glue, boxes of cigars, homemade woodwind instruments, cookery books, a bull roarer, a telescope, a tin of grafting wax, and a hamper marked Fortnum and Mason's on the bottom. The old king heaved a sigh of contentment and forgot about the actual world. "Now, Badger," said Merlin, who was bristling with importance and officiousness, "hand me the minutes of the last meeting."
"We did not take any. There was no ink."
"Never mind. Give me the notes on the great Victorian hubris."
"They were used to light the fire."
"Confound it! Then pass the prophecies."
"Here they are," said the Badger proudly, and he stooped down to scrape together the flood of papers which had shot into the fender when he first stood up. "I had them ready," he explained, "on purpose." They had caught light, however, and when he had blown them out and delivered them to the magician, it was found that all the pages had been burnt in half.
"Really, this is too vexatious. What have you done with the thesis on man and the dissertation concerning might?"
"I had them under my hand a moment ago." And the poor Badger, who was supposed to be the secretary of the committee, but he was not a good one, began rummaging about short-sightedly among the boomerangs, looking very much ashamed and worried. Archimedes said, "It might be easier to do it without papers, master. Just by talking?"
Merlin glared at him.
"We have only to explain," suggested Teenatrix.
Merlin glared at him also.
"It is what we shall have to do in the end," said Balin, "in any case."
Merlin gave up glaring and went into the sulks. Caval, who had come secretly, sneaked into the king's lap with an imploring look and was not prevented. Goat stared into the fire with his jewel eyes. Badger sat down again with a guilty expression, and Hedgehog, sitting primly in his corner away from the others, with his hands folded in his lap, gave an unexpected lead.
"Talon," he said.
Everybody looked at him in surprise, but he was not to be put down. He knew why people moved away when he sat next to them, but Amun had rights for all that. Telon, he repeated.
The king said, I would like it very much if you did tell me. At present I do not understand anything, except that I have been brought here to fill some gaps in this extraordinary education. Could you explain from the beginning?
The trouble is, said Archimedes, that it is difficult to decide which is the beginning.
Tell me about the committee, then. Why are you a committee and what on?
You could say we are the Committee on Might in Man. We have been trying to understand your puzzle.
It is a royal commission, explained the badger proudly. It was felt that a mixture of animals would be able to advise upon the different departments. Here Merlin could contain himself no longer. Even for the sake of his sulks, it was impossible to hold off when it came to talking.
Allow me, he said. I know exactly where to begin, and now I shall do it. Everybody to listen. My dear Wart, he continued, after the hedgehog had said, ear, ear, and as an afterthought, order, order. I must ask you at the outset to cast your mind back to the beginning of my tutorship. Can you remember?
It was with animals.
Exactly. And has it occurred to you that this was not for fun?
Well, it was fun.
But why, we are asking you, with animals?
Suppose you were to tell me.
The magician crossed his knees, folded his arms, and frowned with importance.
There are 250,000 separate species of animal in this world, he said, not counting the living vegetables, and of these no less than 2,850 are mammals like man. They all of them have some form of politics or other. It was the one mistake my old friend Aristotle made when he defined his man as a political animal. Yet man himself, this miserable nonentity among 249,999 others, goes drivelling along his tragic political groove without ever lifting his eyes to the 250,000 examples which surround him. What makes it still more extraordinary is that man is a parvenu among the rest, nearly all of which had already solved his problems in one way or another many thousand years before he was created.
There was a murmur of admiration from the committee, and the grass snake added gently, It was why he tried to give you an idea of nature, King, because it was hoped that when you were struggling with the puzzle, you would look about you.
The politics of all animals, said the badger, deal with the control of might.
But I do not see, he began, only to be anticipated.
Of course you do not see, said Merlin. You were going to say that animals have no politics. Take my advice and think it over.
Have they?
Of course they have, and very efficient ones they are. Some of them are communists or fascists, like many of the ants. Some are anarchists, like the geese. There are socialists, like some of the bees. And indeed, among the 3,000 families of the ant itself, there are other shades of ideology besides fascism. Not all are slave-makers or warfarers. There are bank balance holders, like the squirrel or the bear who hibernates on his fat. Any nest or burrow or feeding ground is a form of individual property. And how do you think the crows, rabbits, minnows, and all the other gregarious creatures contrive to live together if they have not faced the questions of democracy and of force?
It was evidently a well-worn topic, for the badger interrupted before the king could reply.
You have never given us, he said, and you never will give us, an example of capitalism in the natural world.
Merlin looked unhappy.
And, he added. "If you cannot give an example, it only shows that capitalism is unnatural."
The Badger, it may be mentioned, was inclined to be Russian in his outlook. He and the other animals had argued with the magician so much during the past few centuries that they had all come to express themselves in highly magic terms, talking of Bolshevists and Nazis with as much ease as if they had been little more than the Lollards and Thrashers of contemporary history. Merlin, who was a staunch conservative, which was rather progressive of him when you reflect that he was living backwards, defended himself feebly.
"Parasitism," he said, "is an ancient and respectable compartment in nature, from the cuckoo to the flea."
"We are not talking about parasitism. We are talking about capitalism, which has been exactly defined. Can you give me a single example, other than man, of a species whose individuals will exploit the labour value of individuals of the same species? Even fleas do not exploit fleas."
Merlin said,
"There are certain apes which, when kept in captivity, have to be closely watched by their keepers. Otherwise, the dominant individuals will deprive their comrades of food, even compelling them to regurgitate it, and the comrades will starve."
"It seems a shaky example." Merlin folded his hands and looked more unhappy than ever. At last he screwed his courage to the sticking point, took a deep breath, and faced the truth.
"It is a shaky example," he said. "I find it impossible to mention an example of true capitalism in nature."
He had no sooner said it than his hands unfolded themselves like lightning, and the fist of one flashed into the palm of the other.
"I have it," he cried. "I knew I was right about capitalism. We are looking at it the wrong way round."
"We generally are."
"The main specialization of a species is nearly always unnatural to other species. Just because there are no examples of capital in nature, it does not mean that capital is unnatural for man, in the sense of its being wrong. You might as well say it is wrong for a giraffe to eat the tops of trees, because there are no other antelopes with necks as long as his. Or that it was wrong for the first amphibian to crawl out of the water, because there were no other examples of amphibians at the time. Capitalism is man's speciality, just as his cerebrum is. There are no other examples in nature of a creature with a cerebrum like that of man. This does not mean that it is unnatural for man to have a cerebrum. On the contrary, it means that he must go ahead with it. And the same with his capitalism. It is, like his brain, a speciality, a jewel in the crown. Now I come to think of it, capitalism may be actually consequent upon the possession of a developed cerebrum. Otherwise, why should our only other example of capitalism, those apes I mentioned, occur among the anthropoids whose brains are akin to man's? Yes, yes, I knew I was right to be a minor capitalist all the time. I knew there was a sensible reason why the Russians of my youth should have modified their ideas. The fact that it is unique does not mean that it is wrong. On the contrary, it means that it is right. Right for man, of course, not for the other animals. It means...
"Do you realize," asked Archimedes, "that the audience has not understood a single word you are saying for several minutes?"
Merlin stopped abruptly and looked at his pupil, who had been following the conversation with his eyes more than anything else, looking from one face to the other.
"I am sorry."
The king spoke absently, almost as if he were talking to himself.
"Have I been stupid?"
he asked slowly. "Stupid not to notice animals?"
"Stupid!"
cried the magician, triumphant once again, for he was in high delight over his discovery about capital.
"There at last is a crumb of truth on a pair of human lips! Nunc dimittis!"
And he immediately leapt upon his hobby-horse to gallop off in all directions.
"The cheek of the human race," he exclaimed, "is something to knock you footless. Begin with the unthinkable universe. Narrow down to the minute sun inside it. Pass to the satellite of the sun, which we are pleased to call Earth. Glance at the myriad algae, or whatever the things are called, of the sea, and at the uncountable microbes going backwards to a minus infinity which populate ourselves. Drop an eye on those 250,000 other species which I have mentioned, and upon the unmentionable expanses of time through which they have lived. Then, look at man, an upstart, whose eyes, speaking from the point of view of nature, are scarcely open further than the puppy's. There he is, the gollywog!"
He was becoming so excited that he had no time to think of suitable epithets.
"There he is! Dubbing himself Homo sapiens, forsooth, proclaiming himself the lord of creation, like that ass Napoleon putting on his own crown. There he is, condescending to the other animals, even condescending, God bless my soul and body, to his ancestors. It is the great Victorian hubris, the amazing, ineffable presumption of the 19th century. Look at those historical novels by Scott, in which the human beings themselves, because they lived a couple of hundred years ago, are made to talk like imitation warming pans. Man, proud man, stands there in the 20th century, complacently believing that the race has advanced in the course of 1,000 miserable years, and busy blowing his brothers to bits. When will they learn that it takes 1,000,000 years for a bird to modify a single one of its primary feathers? There he stands, the crashing lubber, pretending that everything is different because he has made an internal combustion engine. There he stands, ever since Darwin, because he has heard that there is such a thing as evolution, quite regardless of the fact that evolution happens in 1,000,000-year cycles. He thinks he has evolved since the Middle Ages. Perhaps the combustion engine has evolved, but not he. Look at him, sniggering at his own progenitors, let alone the other types of mammal, in that insufferable Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court. The sheer shattering source of it! And making God in his own image! Believe me, the so-called primitive races who worshipped animals as gods were not so daft as people choose to pretend. At least they were humble. Why should not God have come to the earth as an earthworm? There are a great many more worms than men, and they do a great deal more good. And what is it all about, anyway? Where is this marvellous superiority which makes the 20th century superior to the Middle Ages, and the Middle Ages superior to primitive races and to the beasts of the field? Is man so particularly good at controlling his might and his ferocity and his property? What does he do? He massacres the members of his own species like a cannibal. Do you know that it has been calculated that during the years between 1100 and 1900, the English were at war for 419 years, and the French for 373? Do you know that La Pouge has reckoned that 19 million men are killed in Europe in every century, so that the amount of blood spilled would feed a fountain of blood running 700 litres an hour since the beginning of history? And let me tell you this, dear sir. War, in nature herself, outside of man, is so much a rarity that it scarcely exists. In all those 250,000 species, there are only a dozen or so which go to war. If nature ever troubled to look at man, the little atrocity, she would be socked out of her wits. And finally, concluded the magician,
pulling up into a canter. "Leaving his morals out of account. Is the odious creature important even in a physical sense? Would neutral nature be compelled to notice him more than the green fly or the coral insect, because of the changes which he has effected on the surface of the earth?"
Chapter 4. The king said politely, stunned by such a lot of declamation, "Surely she would. Surely we are important from what we have done."
"How?" demanded his tutor fiercely.
"Well, I must say, look at the buildings which we've made on the earth, and towns and arable fields."
"The Great Barrier Reef," observed Archimedes, looking at the ceiling, "is a building 1,000 miles long, and it was built entirely by insects."
"But that is only a reef." Merlin dashed his hat on the floor in his usual way.
"Can you never learn to think impersonally?" he demanded. "The coral insect would have as much right to reply to you that London is only a town."
"Even then, if all the towns in the world were placed end to end," Archimedes said,
"if you begin producing all the towns in the world, I shall begin producing all the coral islands and atolls. Then we will weigh them carefully against each other, and perhaps we shall see what we shall see."
"Perhaps coral insects are more important than men, then. But this is only one species," Goat said slyly.
"The committee had a note somewhere about the beaver, I think, in which he was said to have made whole seas and continents."
"The birds," began Balin, with exaggerated nonchalance, "by carrying the seeds of trees in their droppings, are said to have made forests so large."
"Them rabbits," interrupted the urchin, "what a nigh deflopulated Australia."
"The foraminifera, of whose bodies the white cliffs of Dover are actually composed, the locusts..." Merlin held up his hand.
"Give him the humble earthworm," he said majestically.
So the animals recited in unison. "The naturalist Darwin has pointed out that there are about 25,000 earthworms in every field acre, that they turn over in England alone 320 million tons of soil a year, and that they are to be found in almost every region of the world. In 30 years, they will alter the whole Earth's surface to the depth of 7 inches. "The Earth without worms," says the immortal Gilbert White, "would soon become cold, hard-bound, void of fermentation, and consequently sterile." Chapter 5.
"It seems to me," said the king happily, for these high matters seemed to be taking him far from Mordred and Lancelot, far from the place where, as they put it in King Lear, humanity must perforce prey on itself like monsters of the deep, into the peaceful world, where people thought and talked and loved each other without the misery of doing. "It seems to me, if what you say is true, that it would do my fellow humans good to take them down a peg. If they could be taught to look at themselves as another species of mammal for a change, they might find the novelty a tonic. Tell me what conclusions the committee has come to, for I'm sure you have been discussing it, about the human animal."
"We have found ourselves in difficulty about the name."
"What name?"
"Homo sapiens," explained the grass snake. "It became obvious that sapiens was hopeless as an adjective, but the trouble was to find another."
Archimedes said, "Do you remember that Merlin once told you why the chaffinch was called coelebs? A good adjective for a species has to be appropriate to some peculiarity of it, like that."
"The first suggestion,"
said Merlin, was naturally ferox, since man is the most ferocious of the animals.
It is strange that you should mention ferox. I was thinking that very word an hour ago.
But you are exaggerating, of course, when you say that he is more ferocious than a tiger.
Am I? I have always found that men were decent on the whole.
Merlin took off his spectacles, sighed deeply, polished them, put them on again, and examined his disciple with curiosity, as if he might at any moment begin to grow some long, soft, furry ears.
"Try to remember the last time you went for a walk," he suggested mildly.
"A walk?"
"Yes, a walk in the English country lanes. Here comes Homo sapiens, taking his pleasure in the cool of the evening. Picture the scene. Here is a blackbird singing in the bush. Does it fall silent and fly away with a curse? Not a bit of it. It sings all the louder and perches on his shoulder. Here is a rabbit nibbling the short grass. Does it rush in terror towards its burrow? Not at all. It hops towards him. Here a field mouse, grass snake, fox, hedgehog, badger. Do they conceal themselves or accept his presence? Why,
cried the old fellow suddenly, flaming out with a peculiar, ancient indignation,
there is not a humble animal in England that does not flee from the shadow of man, as a burned soul from purgatory. Not a mammal, not a fish, not a bird. Extend your walk so that it passes by a river bank, and the very fish will dart away. It takes something, believe me, to be dreaded in all the elements there are. And do not, he added quickly, laying his hands on Arthur's knee, do not imagine that they fly from the presence of one another. If a fox walked down the lane, perhaps the rabbit would scuttle, but the bird in the tree and the rest of them would agree to his being. If a hawk swung by, perhaps the blackbird would cower, but the fox and the others would allow its arrival. Only man, only the earnest member of the Society for the Invention of Cruelty to Animals, only he is dreaded by every living thing.
But these animals are not what you would really call wild. A tiger, for instance.
Merlin stopped him with his hand again.
Let the walk be in the darkest Indies, he said, if you like. There is not a tiger, not a cobra, not an elephant in the Afric jungle, but what he flies from man. A few tigers who have gone mad from toothache will attack him, and the cobra, if hard-pressed, will fight in self-defence. But if a sane man meets a sane tiger on a jungle path, it is the tiger who will turn aside. The only animals which do not run from man are those which have never seen him. The seals, penguins, dodos or whales of the Arctic seas, and these, in consequence, are immediately reduced to the verge of extinction. Even the few creatures which prey on man, the mosquito and the parasitic flea, even these are terrified of their host and keep a sharp lookout to be beyond his fingers. Homo ferox, continued Merlin, shaking his head, that rarity in nature, an animal which will kill for pleasure. There is not a beast in this room who would not scorn to kill except for a meal. Man affects to feel indignation at the shrike who keeps a small larder of snails, etc., speared on thorns. Yet his own well-stocked larder is surrounded by herds of charming creatures, like the mooning bullock and the sheep with its intelligent and sensitive face, who are kept solely in order to be slaughtered on the verge of maturity and devoured by their carnivorous herder, whose teeth are not even designed for those of a carnivore. You should read Lamb's letter to Southey about baking moles alive, and sport with cockchafers,
and cats in bladders, and crimping skates and anglers, those meek inflictors of pangs intolerable. Homo ferox, the inventor of cruelty to animals, who will rear pheasants at enormous expense for the pleasure of killing them, who will go to the trouble of training other animals to kill, who will burn living rats, as I have seen done in Eru, in order that their shrieks may intimidate the local rodents, who will forcibly degenerate the livers of domestic geese in order to make himself a tasty food, who will saw the growing horns off cattle for convenience in transport, who will blind goldfinches with a needle to make them sing, who will boil lobsters and shrimps alive, although he hears their piping screams, who will turn on his own species in war and kill 19 million every 100 years, who will publicly murder his fellow men when he has adjudged them to be criminals, and who has invented a way of torturing his own children with a stick, or of exporting them to concentration camps called schools, where the torture can be applied by proxy? Yes. You are right to ask whether man can properly be described as ferox, for certainly the word, in its natural meaning of wildlife among decent animals, ought never to be applied to such a creature.
Goodness, said the king, you seem to lay it on. But the old magician would not be appeased.
The reason, he said, why we felt doubts about using ferox was because Archimedes suggested that stultus would be more appropriate.
Stultus? I thought we were intelligent.
In one of the miserable wars, when I was a younger man, said the magician, taking a deep breath, it was found necessary to issue to the people of England a set of printed cards which entitled them to food. These cards had to be filled in by hand before the food could be bought. Each individual had to write a number in one part of the card, his name in another part, and the name of the food supplier in a third. He had to perform these three intellectual feats, one number and two names, or else he would get no food and starve to death. His life depended on the operation. It was found in the upshot, so far as I recollect, that two-thirds of the population were unable to perform the sequence without mistake. And these people, we are told by the Catholic Church, are to be trusted with immortal souls.
Are you sure of the facts? Asked the badger doubtfully. The old man had the grace to blush.
I did not note them down, he said, but they are true in substance, if not in detail. I clearly remember, for instance, that a woman was found standing in a queue for bird seed in the same war, who, upon interrogation, was discovered to possess no birds.
Arthur objected.
It does not prove very much, even if they were unable to write their three things properly. If they had been any of the other animals, they would not have been able to write at all.
The short answer to that, replied the philosopher, is that not a single human being can bore a hole in an acorn with his nose.
I do not understand.
Well, the insect called Balaninus elephas is able to bore acorns in the way I mention, but it cannot write. Man can write, but cannot bore acorns. These are their own specializations. The important difference is, however, that while Balaninus bores his holes with the greatest efficiency, man, as I have shown you, does not write with any efficiency at all. That is why I say that species for species, man is more inefficient, more stultus than his fellow beasts. Indeed, no sensible observer would expect the contrary. Man has been so short a time upon our globe that he can scarcely be expected to have mastered much.
The king had found that he was beginning to feel depressed.
Did you think of many other names? He asked.
There was a third suggestion, made by Badger.
At this, the happy Badger shuffled his feet with satisfaction, peeped sideways at the company round the corner of his spectacles, and examined his long nails.
Impoliticus, said Merlin. Homo impoliticus. You remember that Aristotle defined us as political animals. Badger suggested examining this, and after we had looked at his politics, impoliticus seemed to be the only word to use.
Go on, if you must.
We found that the political ideas of Homo ferox were of two kinds. Either that problems could be solved by force, or that they could be solved by argument. The ant-men of the future, who believe in force, consider that you can determine whether 2 is 4 by knocking people down who disagree with you. The Democrats, who are to believe in argument, consider that all men are entitled to an opinion, because all are born equal. I am as good a man as you are, the first instinctive ejaculation of the man who is not.
If neither force nor argument can be relied on, said the king, I do not see what can be done.
Neither force, nor argument, nor opinion, said Merlin with the deepest sincerity, are thinking. Argument is only a display of mental force, a sort of fencing with points in order to gain a victory, not for truth. Opinions are the blind alleys of lazy or of stupid men who are unable to think. If ever a true politician really thinks a subject out dispassionately, even Homo Stultus will be compelled to accept his findings in the end. Opinion can never stand beside truth. At present, however, Homo Impoliticus is content either to argue with opinions or to fight with his fists instead of waiting for the truth in his head. It will take 1,000,000 years before the mass of men can be called political animals.
What are we then at present?
We find that at present the human race is divided politically into 1 wise man, 9 knaves, and 90 fools out of every 100. That is, by an optimistic observer. The 9 knaves assemble themselves under the banner of the most knavish among them and become politicians. The wise man stands out because he knows himself to be hopelessly outnumbered and devotes himself to poetry, mathematics, or philosophy, while the 90 fools plod off behind the banners of the 9 villains, according to fancy, into the labyrinths of chicanery, malice, and warfare. It is pleasant to have command, observes Sancho Panza, even over a flock of sheep, and that is why the politicians raise their banners. It is, moreover, the same thing for the sheep, whatever the banner. If it is democracy, then the 9 knaves will become members of parliament. If fascism, they will become party leaders. If communism, commissars. Nothing will be different, except the name. The fools will be still fools, the knaves still leaders, the results still exploitation. As for the wise man, his lot will be much the same under any ideology. Under democracy, he will be encouraged to starve to death in a garret. Under fascism, he will be put in a concentration camp. Under communism, he will be liquidated. This is an optimistic, but on the whole a scientific statement of the habits of Homo Impoliticus.
The king said grimly, "Well, I am sorry. I suppose I had better go away and drown myself. I am cheeky, insignificant, ferocious, stupid, and impolitic. It hardly seems to be worth our going on." But at this, the animal seemed much upset.
They rose in a body, stood round him, fanned him, and offered him drink.
"No," they said, "really, we were not trying to be rude. Honestly, we were trying to help. There, do not take it to heart. We are sure there must be plenty of humans who are sapiens and not a bit ferocious. We were telling you these things as a sort of foundation, so as to make it easier to solve your puzzle later. Come now, have a glass of Madeira and think no more about it. Truly, we think that man is the most marvellous creature anywhere, quite the best there is."
And they turned upon Merlin crossly, saying, "Now look what you have done. This is the result of all your gibber and jabber. The poor king is perfectly miserable, and all because you throw your weight about and exaggerate and prattle like a poop." Merlin only replied,
"Even the Greek definition, anthropos, he who looks up, is inaccurate. Man seldom looks above his own height after adolescence."
Chapter 6. The new Arthur, the oiled bolt, was cosseted back to good humour. But he immediately committed the blunder of opening the subject once again.
"Surely," he said, "the affections of men, their love and heroism and patience, surely these are respectable things?"
His tutor was not abashed by the scolding which he had received. He accepted the gage with pleasure.
"Do you suppose that the other animals," he asked, "have no love or heroism or patience, or, which is the more important, no cooperative affection? The love lives of ravens, the heroism of a pack of weasels, the patience of small birds nursing a cuckoo, the cooperative love of bees. All these things are shown much more perfectly on every side in nature than they have ever been shown in man."
"Surely," asked the king, "man must have some respectable feature."
At this, his magician relented.
"I am inclined to think," he said, "that there may be one. This, insignificant and childish as it must seem, I mention in spite of all the lucubrations of that fellow Chalmers Mitchell. I refer to man's relation with his pets. In certain households, there are dogs which are of no use as hunters or as watchmen, and cats which refuse to go on mousing, but which are treated with a kind of vicarious affection by their human fellows, in spite of uselessness or even trouble. I cannot help thinking that any traffic in love, which is platonic and not given in exchange for other commodities, must be remarkable. I knew a donkey once who lived in the same field with a horse of the same sex. They were deeply attached to one another, although nobody could see that either of them was able to confer a material benefit on the other. This relationship does, it seems to me, exist to a respectable extent between Homo ferox and his hounds in certain cases. But it also exists among the ants, so we must not put too much store upon it."
Goat observed slyly, "Parasites." At this, Cavell got off his master's lap, and he and the new king walked over to the goat on stiff legs. Cavell spoke in human speech for the first and last time in his long life, in unison with his master. His voice sounded like a Teuton's speaking through a trumpet.
"Did you say parasites?" they asked. "Just say that once again, will you, until we punch your head?"
The goat regarded them with amused affection, but refused to have a row.
"If you punched my head," he said, "you would get a pair of bloody knuckles. Besides, I take it back."
They sat down again, while the king congratulated himself on having something nice in his heart at any rate. Cavell evidently thought the same thing, for he licked his nose.
"What I cannot understand," said Arthur,
is why you should take the trouble to think about man and his problems, or to sit in committee on them, if the only respectable thing about him is the way he treats a few pets. Why not let him extinguish himself without fuss? This set the committee a problem. They remained still to think it over, holding the mahogany fans between their faces and the firelight, and watching the inverted flames in the smoky brown of the Madeira.
"It is because we love you, King, yourself," said Archimedes eventually.
This was the most wonderful compliment which he had ever received.
"It is because the creature is young," said the goat. "Young and helpless creatures make you want to aid them instinctively." "It is because helping is a good thing anyway," said Teenatrix.
"There is something important in humanity," said Balin. "I cannot at present describe it."
Merlin said, "It is because one likes to tinker with things, to play with possibilities." The hedgehog gave the best reason, which was simply, "Why shouldn't one?" Then they fell silent, musing on the flames.
"Perhaps I have painted a dark picture of the humans," said Merlin doubtfully. "Not very dark, but it might have been a shade lighter. It was because I wanted you to understand about looking at the animals. I did not want you to think that man was too grand to do that. In the course of a long experience of the human race, I have learned that you can never make them understand anything unless you rub it in."
"You are wanting me to find something out by learning from the beasts?"
"Yes. At last we are getting to the object of your visit. There are two creatures which I forgot to show you when you were small, and unless you see them now, we shall get no further."
"I will do what you like."
"They are the ant and the wild goose. We want you to meet them tonight. Of course, it will be only one kind of ant, out of many hundreds, but it is a kind which we want you to see."
"Very well," said the king. "I am ready and willing."
"Have you the sanguineer spell at hand, my badger?"
The wretched animal immediately began to rummage in its chair, searching inside the seams, lifting the corner of the carpet, and turning up slips of paper covered with Merlin's handwriting in all directions. The first slip was headed, "More Hubris Under Victoria." It said, "Dr. John of Gaddesden, court physician to Edward II, claimed to have cured the king's son of smallpox by wrapping the patient up in red cloth, putting red curtains on the windows, and seeing that all the hangings of the room were red. This raised a merry Victorian guffaw at the expense of medieval simplicity, until it was discovered by Dr. Niels Finsen of Copenhagen in the 20th century that red and infrared light really did affect the pustules of smallpox, even helping in the cure of the disease." The next slip said briefly, "Half a rose noble each way on golden miller." The third, which smelt strongly of quelque fleur and was not in Merlin's hand, said, "Queen Philippa's monument at Charing Cross, 7:30, under the spire." There were a lot of kisses on the bottom of it, and on the back some notes for a poem to be addressed to the sender. These were in Merlin's writing, and said, "Hui? Kui? Chop suey?" The poem itself, which began, "Kui Nimui?" was erased. Another slip was headed, "Other races, Victorian condescension to, as well as to own ancestors, animals, etc." It said, "Colonel Wood Martin, the antiquarian, writing in 1895, observes with a giggle that one of the most depraved of all races, the now extinct Tasmanians, believed that stones, especially certain kinds of quartz crystals, could be used as mediums or means of communication with living persons at a distance.
Within a few years of this note, wireless was imported into the Western Hemisphere. I prefer to conjecture that these depraved people were a million years in front of the Colonel, along the same foul road, and that they had become extinct by constantly listening to swing music on their crystal sets.
"Here we are," said Badger. "I think this is it."
He handed over a strip on which was written, "Formica est exemplo magni laboris, dative of the purpose." It proved ineffectual. At last, everybody was commanded to stand up, search on their chairs, look in their pockets, etc. The hedgehog, producing a tattered fragment covered with dry mud and crumbled leaves on which he had been sitting, asked, "Beyond thick?" After it had been wiped, flapped and dusted, it was found to read, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard." And Merlin said it was the one they wanted. So a couple of ants' nests were fetched from the meat safe, where they stood supported in saucers of water. They were placed on a table in the middle of the room, while the animals sat down to watch, for you could see inside the nests by means of glass plates coloured red. Arthur was made to sit on the table beside the larger nest. The inverted pentagram was drawn, and Merlin solemnly pronounced the cantrip. Chapter 7. He felt that it was strange to be visiting the animals again at his age. Perhaps, he thought to himself with shame, I am dreaming in my second childhood. Perhaps I am given over to my dotage. But it made him remember his first childhood vividly, the happy times swimming in moats or flying with Archimedes, and he realized that he had lost something since those days. It was something which he thought of now as the faculty of wonder. Then his delights had been indiscriminate. His attention or his sense of beauty or whatever it was to be called had attached itself fortuitously to oddments. Perhaps while Archimedes had been lecturing him about the flight of birds, he himself would have been lost in admiration at the way in which the fur went on the mouse in the owl's claws. Or the great Mr. M. might have been making a speech about dictatorship, while he, all the time, would have seen only the bony teeth pouring on them in an ecstasy of experience. This, his faculty of wonder, was gone from inside him, however much Merlin might have furbished up his brain. It was exchanged for the faculty of discrimination, he supposed. Now he would have listened to Archimedes or to Mr. M. He would never have seen the grey fur or the yellow teeth. He did not feel proud of the change. The old man yawned, for ants do yawn, and they stretch themselves too, just like human beings, when they've had a sleep. After which he gathered his wits for the business in hand. He did not feel pleased to be an ant, as he would have been transported to be one in the old days, but only thought to himself, well, it is a piece of work which I must do. How to begin? The nests were made by spreading earth in a thin layer less than half an inch deep on small tables like footstools. Then, on top of the layer of earth, a sheet of glass was placed with a piece of cloth over it to give darkness for the nurseries. By removing the cloth, you could see into the underground shelters as if you had a cross-section. You could see the circular chamber where the pupae were being tended, as if it were a conservatory with a glass roof. The actual nests were only at the end of the footstools, the glass reaching less than half the way along. In front were plain aprons of earth open to the sky, and at the further end of each footstool there were the watch glasses in which the syrup was left for food. There was no communication between the two nests. The footstools were separate, side by side, but not touching, with their legs in the saucers. Of course, it did not seem like this at the time. The place where he was seemed like a great field of earthen boulders with a flattened fortress at one end of it. The fortress was entered by tunnels, and over the entrance to each tunnel there was a notice which said, "Everything not forbidden is compulsory by new order." He read the notice with a feeling of dislike, though he did not appreciate its meaning, and he thought to himself, "I will take a turn round before going in." For some reason the notice gave him a reluctance to go, making the rough tunnel look sinister. He waved his antennae carefully, considering the notice, assuring himself of his new senses, planting his feet squarely in the new world as if to brace himself in it. He cleaned his antennae with his forefeet, frisking and smoothing them so that he looked like a Victorian villain twirling his mustachios. Then he became conscious of something which had been waiting for consciousness all the time, that there was a noise in his head which was articulate. It was either a noise or a complicated smell, and the easiest way for us to explain it is to say that it was like a wireless broadcast. It came to him through his antennae like music. The music had a monotonous rhythm like a pulse, and the words which went with it were about June, moon, noon, spoon, or mammy, 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 or ever, never, or blue, true, you. He liked them at first, especially the ones about love, dove, above, until he found that they were not variable. As soon as they had been finished once, they were begun again. After an hour or two of them, he was to feel that they would make him scream. There was a voice in his head also, during the pauses of the music, which seemed to be giving directions. "All two-day-olds to be moved to the west aisle," it would say. Or, "Number 210397-WD to report to the syrup squad in replacement of 333105-WD who has fallen off the nest." It was a charming, fruity voice, but it seemed to be somehow impersonal, as if the charm were an accomplishment that had been perfected like a circus trick. It was dead. The king, or perhaps we ought to say the ant, walked away from the fortress as soon as he was prepared to walk about. He began prospecting the desert of boulders uneasily, reluctant to visit the place from which the orders were coming, yet bored with the narrow view. He found small pathways among the boulders, wandering tracks both aimless and purposeful, which led toward the syrup store, and also in various other directions which he could not understand. One of these latter paths ended at a clod with a natural hollow underneath it. In the hollow, again with the queer appearance of aimless purpose, he found two dead ants. They were laid there tidily, but yet untidily, as if a very tidy person had taken them to the place, but forgotten the reason when he got there. They were curled up, and they did not seem to be either glad or sorry to be dead. They were there like a couple of chairs. While he was looking at the two corpses, a live ant came down the pathway, carrying a third. It said, "Hail Sanguinea!" The king said, "Hail," politely. In one respect, of which he knew nothing, he was fortunate. Merlin had remembered to give him the proper smell for this particular nest, for if he had smell of any other nest, they would have killed him at once. If Miss Edith Cavell had been an ant, they would have had to write on her pedestal, "Smell is not enough." The new ant put down its cadaver vaguely and began dragging the other two in various directions. It did not seem to know where to put them, or rather, it knew that a certain arrangement had to be made, but it could not figure out how to make it. It was like a man with a teacup in one hand and a sandwich in the other who wants to light a cigarette with a match. But where the man would invent the idea of putting down the cup and sandwich before picking up the cigarette and match, this ant would have put down the sandwich and picked up the match, then it would have been down with the match and up with the cigarette, then down with the cigarette and up with the sandwich, then down with the cup and up with the cigarette, until finally it had put down the sandwich and picked up the match. It was inclined to rely upon a series of accidents in order to achieve its objects. It was patient and did not think. When it had pulled the three dead ants into several positions, they would doubtless fall into line under the clod eventually, and that was its whole duty. The king watched the arrangements with a surprise which turned into vexation and then into dislike. He felt like asking why it did not think these things out in advance. That annoyed feeling which one has on seeing a job being badly done. Later, he began to wish that he could put several other questions, such as, "Do you like being a sexton?" or, "Are you a slave?" or even, "Are you happy?" But the extraordinary thing was that he could not ask such questions. In order to ask them, he would have had to put them into the ant language through his antennae, and he now discovered, with a helpless feeling, that there were no words for half the things he wanted to say. There were no words for happiness, for freedom, or for liking, nor were there any words for their opposites. He felt like a dumb man trying to shout fire. The nearest he could get to right and wrong, even, was done or not done. The ant finished fiddling with its corpses and turned back down the pathway, leaving them in the queer, haphazard order. It found that Arthur was in its way, so it stopped, waving its wireless aerials at him as if it were a tank. With its mute, menacing helmet of a face, and its hairiness, and the things like spurs at each leg joint, perhaps it was more like a knight in armour on an armoured horse, or like a combination of the two, a hairy centaur in armour. It said, "Hail, Sanguinea!" once again. "Hail." "What are you doing?" The king answered truthfully, but not wisely, "I am not doing anything." It was baffled by this for several seconds, as you would be if Einstein were to tell you his latest ideas about space. Then it extended the 12 joints of its aerial and spoke past him into the blue. It said,
105978 stroke UDC, reporting from square 5. There is an insane ant on square 5. Over to you."
The word it used for insane was not done. Later on, he was to discover that there were only two qualifications in the language, done and not done, which applied to all questions of value. If the syrup which Merlin left for them was sweet, it was a done syrup. If he had left them some corrosive sublimate, it would have been a not done syrup, and that was that. Even the moons, mammies, doves, etc. in the broadcasts were completely described when they were stated to be done ones. The broadcast stopped for a moment, and the fruity voice said, "GHQ replying to 105978 stroke UDC, what is its number? Over." The ant said, "What is your number?"
"I do not know."
When this news had been exchanged with headquarters, a message came back to ask whether he could give an account of himself. The ant asked him whether he could, using the same words as the broadcaster had used and in the same flat voice. It made him feel uncomfortable and angry, two emotions which he disliked. "Yes," he said sarcastically, for it was obvious that the creature could not detect sarcasm. "I have fallen on my head and cannot remember anything about it."
105978 stroke UDC reporting, not done, ant is suffering from concussion through falling off the nest. Over.
GHQ replying to 105978 stroke UDC, not done, ant is number 42436 stroke WD, who fell off the nest this morning while working with Syrup Squad. If it is competent to continue its duties..."
Competent to continue its duties was easier in the ant speech, for it was simply done, like everything else that was not done. But enough of this language question.
If it is competent to continue its duties, instruct 42436-WD to rejoin Syrup Squad, relieving 210021-WD, who was sent to replace it. Over.
Do you understand?
Asked the ant. It seemed that he could not have made a better explanation of himself than this about falling on his head, even if he had meant to. For the ants did occasionally tumble off their footstools, and Merlin, if he happened to notice them, would lift them back with the end of his pencil. Yes. The sexton paid no further attention to him, but crawled off down the path for another body or for anything else that needed to be scavenged. Arthur took himself away in the opposite direction, to join the Syrup Squad, memorizing his own number and the number of the unit who had to be relieved. Chapter 8. The Syrup Squad was standing motionless round the watch glass, like a circle of worshippers. He joined the circle, announcing that 210021-WD was to return to the nest. Then he began filling himself with the sweet nectar like the others. At first it was delicious to him, so that he ate greedily, but in a few seconds it began to be unsatisfactory. He could not understand why. He ate hard, copying the rest of the squad, but it was like eating a banquet of nothing, or like a dinner party on the stage. In a way, it was like a nightmare, under which you might continue to consume huge masses of putty without being able to stop. There was a coming and going round the watch glass. Those ants who had filled their crops to the brim were walking back to the fortress to be replaced by a procession of empty ants who were coming from the same direction. There were never any new ants in the procession, but only the same dozen going backwards and forwards as they would do during all their lives. He realized suddenly that what he was eating was not going into his stomach. Only a tiny proportion of it had penetrated to his private self at the beginning, and now the main mass was being stored in a kind of upper stomach or crop from which it could be removed. It dawned on him at the same time that when he joined the westward stream, he would have to disgorge this store into a larder or something of that sort. The sugar squad conversed with each other while they worked. He thought this was a good sign at first, and listened to pick up what he could.
"Oh, hark," one of them would say, "here comes that mammy, 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 mammy song again. I do think that mammy, 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 mammy song is lovely."
Done.
"It is so high class."
Done. Another would remark,
"I do think our beloved leader is wonderful, do not you? They say she was stung 300 times in the last war and was awarded the Ant Cross for valour." "How lucky we are to be born of the sanguineer blood, don't you think? And would it not be awful to be one of those filthy, formiki fusky?" "Was it not awful about 310099-WD, who refused to disgorge his syrup when he was asked? Of course he was executed at once by special order of our beloved leader." "Oh, hark! Here comes that mammy, 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 mammy song again, I do think."
He walked off to the nest with a full gorge, leaving them to do the round again. For they had no news, no scandal, nothing to talk about. Novelties did not happen to them. Even the remarks about the executions were in a formula, and only varied as to the registration number of the criminal. When they had finished with the mammy, 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 they had to go on to the beloved leader, and then to the filthy fusky, and to the latest execution. It went round in a circle. Even the beloveds, wonderfuls, luckies, and so on, were all duns, and the awfuls were not duns. He found himself in the vast hall of the fortress, where hundreds and hundreds of ants were licking or feeding in the nurseries, carrying grubs to various aisles in order to get an even temperature, and opening or closing the ventilation passages. In the middle, the giant leader sat complacently, laying eggs, attending to the broadcasts, issuing directions or commanding executions, surrounded by a sea of adulation. He learned later from Merlin that the method of succession among these leaders was variable according to the different species of ant. In Bothrio Myrmex, for instance, the ambitious founder of a new order would invade a nest of Tapinoma and jump upon the back of the older tyrant. There, dissimulated by the smell of her host, she would slowly saw off her head until she herself had achieved the right of leadership. There was no larder for his store of syrup after all. He found that he must walk about like a living dumb waiter at the convenience of the indoor workers. When they wanted a meal, they stopped him. He opened his mouth, and they fed from it. They did not treat him as a person, and indeed they were impersonal themselves. He was a dumb waiter from which dumb diners fed. Even his stomach was not his own. But do not let us go on about these ants in too much detail. They are not a pleasant topic. He lived among them patiently, conforming to their habits, watching them in order to understand as much as possible, but unable to ask them questions. It was not only that their language was destitute of the words in which he was interested, so that it was impossible to ask them whether they believed in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but also that it was dangerous to ask them questions at all. A question was a sign of insanity to them, because their life was not questionable. It was dictated. He crawled from nest to syrup and back again, exclaimed that the mammy song was lovely, opened his jaws to regurgitate, and tried to understand as well as he could. He had reached the screaming stage when the enormous hand came down from the clouds carrying a straw. It placed the straw between the two nests, which had been separate before, so that now there was a bridge between them. Then it went away. Chapter 9. Later in the day, a black ant came wandering over the new bridge, one of the wretched Fusci, a humble race who would only fight in self-defence. It was met by one of the scavengers and murdered. The broadcasts changed after this news had been reported, as soon as it had been established by spies that the Fusca nest had also its glass of syrup. Mammy, mammy, mammy gave place to Antland, Antland over all, while the stream of orders were discontinued in favour of lectures about war, patriotism, and the economic situation. The fruity voice announced that their beloved country was being encircled by a horde of filthy Fusci, at which the wireless chorus sang, "When Fusca blood spurts from the knife, then everything is fine." And it also explained that Ant the Father had ordained in his inscrutable wisdom that black pismires should always be the slaves of red ones. Their beloved country had no slaves at present, a disgraceful state of affairs which would have to be remedied if the master race were not to perish. A third statement was that the national property of Sanguinea was being threatened. Their syrup was to be stolen, their domestic animals, the beetles, were to be kidnapped, and their communal stomach would be starved. The king listened to two of these talks carefully, so that he was able to remember them afterwards. The first one was arranged as follows. A. We are so numerous that we are starving. B. Therefore we must not cut down our numbers, but encourage large families in order to become still more numerous and starving. C. When we are so numerous and starving as all that, obviously we have a right to take other people's syrup. Besides, we shall by then have a numerous and starving army. It was only after this logical train of thought had been put into practice and the output of the nurseries trebled Merlin meanwhile giving them ample syrup daily for all their needs, for it has to be admitted that starving nations never seem to be quite so poor that they cannot afford to have far more expensive armaments than anybody else, that the second type of lecture was commenced. This is how the second kind went. A. We are more numerous than they are, therefore we have a right to their syrup. B. They are more numerous than we are, therefore they are wickedly trying to steal our syrup. C. We are a mighty race, and have a natural right to subjugate their puny one. D. They are a mighty race, and are unnaturally trying to subjugate our inoffensive one. E. We must attack in self-defense. F. They are attacking us by defending themselves. G. If we do not attack them today, they will attack us tomorrow. H. In any case, we are not attacking them at all. We are offering them incalculable benefits. After the second type of address, the religious services began. These dated, he discovered, from a fabulous past so ancient that he could scarcely find a date for it, in which the Emmets had not yet settled down to socialism. They came from a time when ants were still like men, and terribly impressive some of them were. A psalm at one of these services, beginning, if we allow for the difference of language, with the well-known words, "The earth is the sword's, and all that therein is, the compass of the bomber, and they that bomb therefrom," ended with the terrific conclusion, "Blow up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye blown up, ye everlasting doors, that the King of Tories may come in. Who is the King of Tories? Even the Lord of Ghosts. He is the King of Tories." A strange feature was that the common ants were neither exalted by the songs nor interested by the lectures. They accepted them as matters of course. They were rituals to them, like the mammy songs or the conversations about their beloved leader. They did not regard these things as good or bad, exciting, rational, or terrible. They did not regard them at all, but accepted them as done. Well, the time came for the slave war. All the preparations were in order, all the soldiers were drilled to the last ounce, all the walls of the nest carried patriotic slogans such as "Stings or Syrup," or "I vow to thee my smell," and the king was past hoping. He thought he had never been among such horrible creatures, unless it were at the time when he had lived among men, and he was beginning to sicken with disgust. The repetitive voices in his head, which he could not shut off, the absence of all privacy, under which others ate from his stomach while others again sang in his brain, the dreary blank which replaced feeling, the dearth of all but two values, the monotony more even than the callous wickedness, these had killed the joy of life which had been Merlin's gift at the beginning of the evening. He was as miserable again as he had been when the magician found him weeping at his papers. And now, when the Red Army marched to war at last, he suddenly faced about in the middle of the straw like an insane creature, ready to oppose their passage with his life. Chapter 10.
"Dear God," said Merlin, who was patting the beads of sweat on his forehead with a handkerchief, "you certainly have a flair for getting into trouble. That was a difficult minute."
The animals looked at him anxiously to see if any bones were broken.
"Are you safe?"
"Perfectly."
They discovered that he was furiously angry. His hands were trembling with rage.
"The brutes!" he exclaimed. "The brutes!"
"They are not attractive."
"I would not have minded," he burst out, "if they had been wicked, if they had wanted to be wicked. I would not have minded if they had chosen to be wicked for some reason or for fun. But they did not know they had not chosen. They did not exist.
Sit
down, said the badger, and have some rest.
The horrible creatures! It was like talking to minerals which could move, like talking to statues or to machines. If you said something which was suitable to the mechanism, then it worked. If not, it did not work. It stood still. It was blank. It had no expression. Oh, Merlin, how hideous! They were the walking dead. When did they die? Did they ever have any feelings? They have none now. They were like that door in the fairy story, which opened when you said sesame. I believe that they only knew about a dozen words or collections of words. A man with those in his mind could have made them do all the things they could do, and then you would have had to start again, and again, and again, and again. It was like being in hell, except that none of them knew they were there, none of them knew anything. Is there anything more terrible than perpetual motion, than doing and doing and doing, without a reason, without a consciousness, without a change, without an end?
Ants are perpetual motion, said Merlin, I suppose. I never thought of that.
The most dreadful thing about them was that they were like human beings. Not human, but like humans. A bad copy.
There is nothing surprising in that. The ants adopted the line of politics which man is flirting with at present in the infinite past. They perfected it 30 million years ago, so that no further development was possible. And since then, they have been stationary. Evolution ended with the ants some 30 million years before the birth of Christ. They are the perfect communist state.
Here Merlin raised his eyes devoutly to the ceiling and remarked,
"My old friend Marx may have been a first-rate economist, but holy ghost, he was a by-our-lady rotten hand at natural history."
Badger, who always took the kindly view of everybody, even of Karl Marx, whose arrangement of his materials was about as lucid as the badger's, by the way, said,
"Surely that is hardly fair to actual communism.
I would have thought that ants were more like Mordred's fascists than John Ball's communists. The one is a stage of the other. In perfection, they are the same.
But in a proper communist world..."
"Give the king some wine," said Merlin. "Urchin, what on earth are you thinking about?"
The hedgehog scuttled off for the decanter and brought it with a glass. He thrust a moist nose against the king's ear, breathed heavily into it with a breath that smelt of onions, and whispered hoarsely,
"Us war a watchin' of ye, us war. Trust Tiggy. Thou woulda beat em, thou would, mollicky beasts."
Here he nodded his head repeatedly, spilled the Madeira, and made boxing movements against the air with the decanter in one hand and the glass in the other.
"Three cheers for his majesty is what us says. That's what us says. Let un get at him, us says, for to lay down me life with the shire. And us would ha' done that, us would, bim-bam, only for they wouldn't let un."
Badger did not wish to be cheated of his defence. He began again patiently as soon as the king was served.
"The ants fight wars," he said, "so they cannot be communists. In a proper communist world, there would be no war, because the whole world would be a union. You must not forget that communism has not been properly achieved until all the nations in the world are communistic and fused together in a union of socialist Soviet republics. Now, the anthills are not fused with one another into a union, so they are not fully communistic. And that is why they fight."
"They are not united," said Merlin crossly, "only because the smallness of the anthills, compared with the bigness of the world, and of the natural obstacles such as rivers and so forth, makes communication impossible for animals of their size and number of fingers. Still, if you like, I will agree that they are perfect thrashers, prevented from developing into perfect lollards by geographic and physical features."
"You must therefore withdraw your criticism of Karl Marx."
"Withdraw my criticism?" exclaimed the philosopher.
"Yes,
for Marx did solve the king's puzzle of war by his union of SSR. Merlin became blue in the face, bit off a large piece of his beard, pulled out tufts of his hair and threw them in the air, prayed fervently for guidance, sat down beside the badger, and, taking him by the hand, looked beseechingly into his spectacles. "But do you not see," he asked pathetically, "that a union of anything will solve the problem of war? You cannot have war in a union, because there must be a division before you can begin one. There would be no war if the world consisted of a union of mutton chops. But this does not mean that we must all rush off and become a series of mutton chops." "In fact," said the badger, after pondering for some time, "you are not defining the ants as fascists or communists because they fight wars, but because..." "I am lumping all three sects together on their basic assumption, which is, ultimately, to deny the rights of the individual." "I see. Theirs is the totalitarian theory, that men or ants exist for the sake of the state or world, not vice versa." "And why did you say that Marx was bad at natural history?" "The character of my old friend Karl," said the magician severely, "is outside the province of this committee. Kindly remember that we are not sitting on communism, but on the problem of organized murder. It is only in so far as communism is contingent with war that we are concerned with him at all. With this proviso, I reply to your question as follows: that Marx was a bad naturalist because he committed the gross blunder of overlooking the human skull in the first place, because he never considered the geese, and because he subscribed to the égalité fallacy, which is abhorrent to nature. Human beings are no more equal in their merits and abilities than they are equal in face and stature. You might just as well insist that all the people in the world should wear the same size of boot. This ridiculous idea of equality was adopted by the ants more than 30 million years ago, and by believing it all that time they've managed to make it true. Now look what a mess they are in."
"Liberty, equality, and fraternity," began the badger.
"Liberty, brutality, and obscenity," rejoined the magician promptly. "You should try living in some of the revolutions which use that slogan. First, they proclaim it. Then they announce that the aristos must be liquidated on high moral grounds in order to purge the party or to prune the commune or to make the world safe for democracy. And then they rape and murder everybody they can lay their hands on, more in sorrow than in anger, or crucify them, or torture them in ways which I do not care to mention. You should have tried the Spanish Civil War. Yes, that is the equality of man. Slaughter anybody who is better than you are, and then we shall all be equal soon enough. All equally dead."
Chapter 11. T. Natrix spoke up suddenly.
"You humans," he said, "have no idea of the eternity which you prattle about, with your souls and purgatories and so on. If any of you really did believe in eternity, or even in very long stretches of time, you would think twice about equality. I can imagine nothing more terrifying than an eternity filled with men who were all the same. The only thing which has made life bearable in the long past has been the diversity of creatures on the surface of the globe. If we had all been equal, all one sort of creature, we should have begged for euthanasia long ago. Fortunately, there is no such thing in nature as equality of ability, merit, opportunity, or reward. Every species of animal which is still alive, we leave aside the things like ants, is intensely individualistic, thanks be to God. Otherwise, we should die of boredom,
or become automatons. Even sticklebacks, which on a first inspection you would think were pretty much the same as one another, even sticklebacks have geniuses and dunces all competing for the morsel of food, and it is the geniuses who get it. There was a man who always fed his sticklebacks by putting a glass jar into the aquarium with the food inside it. Some of them found the way in after 3 or 4 attempts and remembered it, while others, so far as I know or care, are trying still. If this were not so, eternity would be too terrible to contemplate, because it would be devoid of difference and therefore change.
None of this is in order. We are supposed to be considering war.
Very well.
King, asked the magician, can you face the geese yet, or do you want to rest? It is impossible, he added in parentheses, to consider the subject sensibly until he has the facts.
The old man said, I think I must rest. I am not so young as I was, in spite of your massage, and you have been asking me to learn a great many things in little time. Can you spare a few short minutes?
Certainly. The nights are long. Urchin, dip this handkerchief in vinegar and put it on his head. There, put your feet on a chair and close your eyes. Now then, everybody is to keep quite quiet and give him air.
So the animals sat as still as mice, nudging each other when they coughed, and the king, with closed eyes and a sense of thankfulness, slipped into his own thoughts. For they had been pressing him hard. It was difficult to learn it in one night, and he was only human as well as old. Perhaps, after all, the careworn person who had been brought from the tent at Salisbury ought never to have been Merlin's choice. He had been an undistinguished child, although he had been a loving one, and he was far from being a genius still. Perhaps, after all, the whole of our long story has been about a rather dim old gentleman who would have been better off at Cranford or at Badger's Green, arranging for the village cricket and the choir treat. There was a thing which he had been wanting to think about. His face, with the hooded eyes, ceased to be like the boy's of long ago. He looked tired and was the king, which made others watch him seriously, with fear and sorrow. They were good and kind, he knew. They were people whose respect he valued. But their problem was not the human one. It was well for them, who had solved their social questions before his men were ever on the earth, to consider wisely in their happy college of life. Their benevolence, with wine and firelight and security towards each other, was easier for them than his sad work for him, their tool. The old king's eyes being shut, he slid back into the real world from which he had come. His wife abducted, his best friend banished, his nephews slain, his son at his throat. The worst was the impersonal, that all his fellow beings were in it. It was true indeed that man was ferocious, as the animals had said. They could say it abstractly, even with a certain dialectic glee, but for him it was the concrete. It was for him to live among yahoos in flesh and blood. He was one of them himself, cruel and silly like them, and bound to them by the strange continuum of human consciousness. He was an Englishman, and England was at war. However much he hated it, or willed to stop it, he was lapped round in a real but intangible sea of English feeling which he could not control. To go against it, to wrestle with the sea, was more than he could face again. And he had been working all his life. He knew he was not a clever man. Goaded by the conscience of that old scientist who had fastened on his soul in youth, hag-ridden and devoured,
burdened like Sinbad, stolen away from himself and claimed remorselessly for abstract service, he had toiled for Grammary since before he could remember. He had not even understood the whole of what he was doing, a beast of burden tugging at the traces. And always, he now saw, Merlin had been behind him, that very ruthless old believer. And man in front, ferocious, stupid, unpolitical. They wanted him, he now saw, to go back to the labour, to do it worse and more. Just when he had given up, just when he had been weeping and defeated, just when the old ox had dropped in the traces, they had come again to prick him to his feet. They had come to teach a further lesson and to send him on. But he had never had a happiness of his own, never had himself, never since he was a little boy in the Forest Sauvage. It was not fair to steal away everything from him. They had made him like the blinded goldfinch they were speaking of, which was to pour out its song for man until it burst its heart, but always blind. He felt, now that they had made him younger, the intense beauty of the world which they denied him. He wanted to have some life, to lie upon the earth and smell it, to look up into the sky like Anthropos and lose himself in clouds. He knew suddenly that nobody, living upon the remotest, most barren crag in the ocean, could complain of a dull landscape so long as he would lift his eyes. In the sky there was a new landscape every minute, in every pool of the sea rocks a new world. He wanted time off to live. He did not want to be sent back to pull with lowered eyes at the weary yoke. He was not quite old even now. Perhaps he would be able to live for another 10 years, but years in the sunlight, years without loads, years with the birds singing as they did sing still, no doubt, although he had ceased to notice them until the animals reminded him. Why must he go back to Homo ferox, probably to be killed by those he was trying to help, certainly, if not to die in harness, when he could abdicate the labour? He could walk out now, straight from the tumulus, and be seen no more. The monks of the Thebaid, the early saints on Skellig Michael, these fortunate people had escaped from man into a nature which was surrounded by peace. And that was what he wanted, he discovered, more than anything else, only peace. Earlier in the evening he had wanted death, and had been ready to accept it. But now they had given him a glimpse of life, of the old happiness and of the things he had loved. They had revived, how cruelly, his boyhood. He wanted to be let alone, to be off duty like a boy, to retire perhaps into a cloister, to have tranquillity for his own old heart. But they woke him with words, their cruel, bright weapons.
"Now then, King, we must see to these geese, or the night will be over."
"Do you feel better?"
"Has anybody seen the cantrip?"
"You are looking tired. Have a sip of wine before you go."
Chapter 12. The place where he was absolutely flat. In the human world we seldom see flatness, for the trees and houses and hedges give a serrated edge to the landscape. Even the grass sticks up with its myriad blades. But here, in the belly of the night, the illimitable flat, wet mud was as featureless as a dark junket. If it had been wet sand, even, it would have had those little wave marks, like the palate of one's mouth. And in this enormous flatness there lived one element, the wind. For it was an element, it was a dimension, a power of darkness. In the human world, the wind comes from somewhere and goes somewhere,
and as it goes, it passes through somewhere, through trees or streets or hedgerows. This wind came from nowhere. It was going through the flatness of nowhere to no place. Horizontal, soundless except for a peculiar boom, tangible, infinite, the astounding dimensional weight of it streamed across the mud. You could have ruled it with a straight edge. The titanic grey line of it was unwavering and solid. You could have hooked the crook of your umbrella over it, and it would have hung there. The king, facing into this wind, felt that he was uncreated. Except for the wet solidity under his webbed feet, he was living in nothing, a solid nothing, like chaos. His were the feelings of a point in geometry, existing mysteriously on the shortest distance between two points, or of a line, drawn on a plane surface, which had length, breadth, but no magnitude. No magnitude! It was the very self of magnitude. It was power, current, force, direction, a pulseless world stream, steady in limbo. Bounds had been set to this unhallowed purgatory. Far away to the east, perhaps a mile distant, there was an unbroken wall of sound. It surged a little, seeming to expand and contract, but it was solid. It was menacing, being desirous for victims, for it was the huge, the remorseless sea. 2 miles to the west, there were three spots of light in a triangle. They were the weak wicks from fishermen's cottages, who had risen early to catch a tide in the complicated creeks of the salt marsh. Its waters sometimes ran contrary to the ocean. These were the total features of his world. The sea sound and the three small lights. Darkness, flatness, vastness, wetness. And in the gulf of night, the gulf stream of the wind. When daylight began to come, by premonition, he found that he was standing among a crowd of people like himself. They were seated on the mud, which now began to be disturbed by the angry, thin, returning sea, or else were already riding on the water, wakened by it, outside the annoyance of the surf. The seated ones were large teapots, their spouts tucked under their wings. The swimming ones occasionally ducked their heads and shook them. Some, waking on the mud, stood up and wagged their tails vigorously. Their profound silence became broken by a conversational gabble. There were about 400 of them in the grey vicinity, very beautiful creatures, the wild, white-fronted geese, whom, once a man has seen them, he will never forget. Long before the sun came, they were making ready for their flight. Family parties of the previous year's breeding were coming together in batches, and these batches were themselves inclined to join up with other ones, possibly under the command of a grandfather, or of a great-grandfather, or else of some noted leader in the host. When the drafts were complete, there came a faint tone of excitement into their speech. They began moving their heads from side to side in jerks, and then, turning into the wind, suddenly they would all be in the air together, 14 or 40 at a time, with wide wings scooping the blackness and a cry of triumph in their throats. They would wheel round, climbing rapidly, and be gone from sight. 20 yards up, they were invisible in the dark. The earlier departures were not vocal. They were inclined to be taciturn before the sun came, only making occasional remarks or crying their single warning note if danger threatened. Then, at the warning, they would all rise vertically to the sky. He began to feel an uneasiness in himself. The dim squadrons about him, setting out minute by minute, infected him with a tendency. He became restless to embrace their example, but he was shy. Perhaps their family groups, he thought, would resent his intrusion. Yet he wanted not to be lonely. He wanted to join in and to enjoy the exercise of morning flight, which was so evidently a pleasure to them. They had a comradeship, a free discipline and joie de vivre. When the goose next to him spread her wings and leapt, he did so automatically. Some 8 of those nearby had been jerking their bills, which he had imitated as if the act were catching, and now, with these same 8, he found himself on pinion in the horizontal air. The moment he had left the earth, the wind had vanished. Its restlessness and brutality had dropped away, as if cut off by a knife. He was in it, and at peace. The 8 geese spread out in line astern, evenly spaced, with him behind. They made for the east, where the poor lights had been, and now, before them, the bold sun began to rise. A crack of orange broke the black cloud bank far beyond the land, the glory spread, the salt marsh growing visible below. He saw it like a featureless moor or bogland, which had become maritime by accident, its heather, still looking like heather, having mated with the seaweed, until it was a salt-wet heather, with slippery fronds. The burns which should have run through the moorland were of seawater on bluish mud. There were long nets here and there erected on poles into which unwary geese might fly. These, he now guessed, had been the occasions of those warning notes. 2 or 3 widgeon hung in one of them, and far away to the eastward, a fly-like man was plodding over the slob in tiny persistence to collect his bag. The sun, as it rose, tinged the quicksilver of the creeks and the gleaming slime itself with flame. The curlew, who had been piping their mournful plaints since long before the light, flew now from weed bank to weed bank. The widgeon, who had slept on water, came whistling their double notes, like whistles from a Christmas cracker. The mallard toiled from land against the wind. The redshank scuttled and prodded like mice. A cloud of tiny dunlin, more compact than starlings, turned in the air with the noise of a train. The blackguard of crows rose from the pine trees on the dunes with merry cheers. Shorebirds of every sort populated the tideline, filling it with business and beauty. The dawn, the sea dawn, and the mastery of ordered flight were of such intense beauty that he was almost moved to sing. All the sorrow of his thoughts about man, the miserable wishes for peace which had beset him in the combination room so lately, these fell from him for the moment in the glory of his wings. He would have liked to cry a chorus to life, and since 1,000 geese were on the wing about him, he had not long to wait. The lines of these creatures, wavering like smoke upon the sky as they breasted the sunrise, were all at once in music and in laughter. Each squadron of them was in different voice, some larking, some triumphant, some in sentiment or glee. The vault of daybreak filled itself with heralds, and this is what they sang. O turning world, pouring beneath our pinions, hoist the hoar sun to welcome morning's minions. See on each breast the scarlet and vermilion, hear from each throat the clarion and carillon. Mark the wild wandering lines in black battalions, heaven's horns and hunters, dawn-bright hounds and stallions. Free, free, far, far, and fair on wavering wings, comes answer Albifrons, and sounds and sings.
Chapter 13. He found himself in a coarse field in daylight. His companions of the flight were grazing round him, plucking the grass with sideways wrenches of their soft bills, bending their necks into abrupt loops, unlike the graceful curves of the swan. Always as they fed, one of their number was on guard, its head erect and snake-like. They had mated during the winter months, or else in previous winters,
so that they tended to feed in pairs within the family and squadron. The young female, his neighbour of the mudflats, was unmated. She kept an intelligent eye upon him. The old man, who had remembered his boyhood, watching her secretly, could not help thinking she was beautiful. He even felt a tenderness towards her downy breast, as yet quite innocent of bars, towards her plump, compacted frame and the neat furrows of her neck. These furrows, he saw out of the corner of his eye, were caused by a difference in the feathering. The feathers were concave, which separated them from one another, making a texture of ridges, which he considered graceful. Presently the young woman gave him a shove with her bill. She had been acting sentry.
"Go on," she said vulgarly. "You next."
She lowered her head without waiting for an answer, and began to graze in the same movement. Her feeding took her from his side. He stood as sentry. He did not know what he was watching, nor could he see any enemy except the tussocks and his nibbling mates, but he was not sorry to be a trusted sentinel. He was surprised to find that he was not averse to seeming masculine, in case the lady might be watching. He was still too innocent, after all his years, to know that she would certainly be doing so.
"Whatever are you doing?" she asked, passing him after half an hour.
"I was on guard."
"Go on with you," she said with a giggle. "Or should it be a gaggle? You are a silly one."
"Why?"
"Go on, you know."
"Honestly," he said, "I do not. Am I doing it wrong? I do not understand."
"Peck the next one. You've been on for twice your time, at least."
He did as he was bid, at which the grazer next to him took over, and then he walked along to feed beside her. They nibbled, noting each other out of beady eyes, until he came to a decision.
"You think I am stupid," he said awkwardly, confessing the secret of his species for the first time in a varied intercourse with animals. "But it is because I am not a goose. I was born a human. This is my first flight among the grey people."
She was only mildly surprised.
"It is unusual," she said. "The humans generally try the swans. The last lot we had were the children of Lear. However, I suppose we're all anseriforms together."
"I have heard of the children of Lear."
"They did not enjoy it. They were hopelessly nationalistic and religious, which resulted in their always hanging about round one of the chapels in Ireland. You could say that they hardly noticed the other swans at all."
"I am enjoying it," he said politely.
"I noticed you were. What were you sent for?"
"To learn about the world." They grazed away in silence, until his own words reminded him of his mission.